Seeds of Darkness, unknown date, 1997, Sudan. Jafar was nearly asleep. Darkness had arrived, and for a young boy in the remote village of Heglig, that meant a time for prayer followed by slumber. The heat and blinding light of Sudan's morning, along with its fresh demands, would arrive soon enough. The hut was modest, two rooms, cobbled from mud, straw, and sand, with unglazed windows and a plywood door with a leather strap handle. Like most of Sudan's population, Jafar's family was poor. A nearby well served as their only water source. A rusty barrel converted to a grill was used for cooking, and the low-voltage electricity worked only some of the time, if they were lucky. In Sudan's desert air, sounds tended to carry well, and as a distant turmoil amplified in volume, Jafar's eyes popped open. His feet swung over the edge of the cot, and he moved to the window where he pulled back the threadbare cloth and rose onto his toes. He spotted a crowd of 30 or more men carrying oil-lit torches and dragging a dark-skinned man, a Dinka most likely, he thought, toward the southern edge of town. Curiosity growing, Jafar scampered through the glassless opening and was soon mingling among men too consumed with rage to notice an insignificant boy of 12 within their midst. The riotous pack moved like a perilous tempest down the village lane and up a crest toward a large adobe-style house atop the hill. Mulla Zuhaya's home, forbidden to women and children. Ensnared within the mast of bodies, the boy was swept through the rear entry and down a steep flight of earthen steps. The instant his bare feet touched the dampened cellar floor, he broke from the throng and slipped toward a shadowed corner. There, concealed behind a cluster of wooden crates, the boy was able to soak in the unfolding drama in obscurity. They strapped the accused, a lanky African with midnight skin, into a sturdy chair near the center of the room. Then an ominous wooden contraption was brought forward and positioned before him. Jafar had never witnessed such fear in a man's eyes, and thoughts of the strange device and what it might mean drew beads of sweat to Jafar's temples. Men from Heglig continued to file down the narrow stairwell, cramming the low-ceilinged cellar where they jockeyed for position. Garbled murmurings flooded the boy's ears. The cellar air, already musty and foul, had become laced with testosterone and perspiration. As his eyes roamed the throng of men, Jafar did a double take. Seated in one of three chairs placed adjacent to the accused was his father. To his father's right sat a ghoulish man draped in a long black robe. The third chair remained empty. Moments later, the room quieted to a low din as Mulla Zuhair Panjwani descended the steps and purposefully approached. Defined by his riveting eyes and long white hair capped by a black turban, the elderly mullah stood before the accused with an air of authority and began to cite the reasoning for this arrest. The people of Heglig have pledged to protect the oil-rich basin of Mughlad, and sabotage of its oil rigs and underground pipelines will not be tolerated. Such disruptions delay the flow of oil and rob our beloved President al-Bashir and the people of Sudan millions of dollars. This is an affront to Islam. Those who have aided John Garang, the leader of the SPLA and a sworn enemy of Sudan, will be punished. The mullah leveled his gaze toward the accused and concluded, "The names and hiding places of those involved need to be extracted and an example made." When the accused attempted to speak, Jafar's father rose to offer a brief translation. "The Dinka tribesman is claiming blamelessness and is insisting he be released." With a look from the mullah, the boy's father grabbed a nearby stick and whacked it across the face of the accused, cutting the vocal defiance short. The mullah stepped forward, lowered his face to the Dinkas, and demanded the infidel come clean before Allah by divulging all he knew. The Dinka's reply, translated by Jafar's father as words of further denial, resulted in the stick striking harder. The message was clear. Anything short of confession would not be tolerated. The mullah continued to press his case, and with each subsequent renunciation of the charges, the beating became more vicious. Rivulets of blood traversed down the face of the accused, yet he refused to confess. As the Dinka howled in pain, the crowd ridiculed him and chanted, "Kill the infidel! Kill the infidel!" Covering his ears, Jafar considered fleeing. The sight of blood had sickened him, yet he remained rooted where he was, mesmerized by the brutality of mob-inspired injustice. The mullah eventually turned a defiant back to the accused and gestured to the black-cloaked man who rose from his seat, a large container shrouded by thick cloth cradled in his arms. The Dinka attempted to rise and flee. Guards swarmed in, pinioning the prisoner's neck and arms to the device with leather straps, and then shoved his chair against the base of the wooden contraption. Jafar now understood the ominous device for what it was, a primitive instrument of torture. With the shrouded box now secured atop the contraption, within inches of the man's bound face, the black-cloaked man swept the cloth covering away, revealing a wire cage. A blur of dark fur with claws began to scratch madly against the mesh wiring of the cage door. Rats in Sudan often grow as large as cats, and this was larger than most and clearly ravenous. Separated from the Dinka's face by a mere weave of thin wire, the tang of human blood spurred the creature's appetite. The Dinka's face froze in fear, eyes locked onto the rat. A scream caught in his throat. Jafar's skin felt hot and clammy despite the deep chill that ran up and down his spine. He shivered. The tension in the room thickened. An electrifying buzz surged through the crowd. The mullah stood at the side of the accused and said, "Confess now before Allah and spare your life," as the ghoulish man teased the length of chain connected to the cage door, daring it to open. Sweat flowed from the Dinka's brow, and the muscles beneath the skin of his taut face twitched involuntarily. A flick of the executioner's wrist was all that separated him from his worst nightmare. The Dinka tribesman could take no more. With fear suffocating his resolve, the Dinka's bravado melted into the pitiful sobs of a broken man. Summoning his well-versed art of interrogation, the mullah placed his hand between the cage door and the tribesman's face. "Admit your guilt. Give me the names of those involved. Tell me where they are hiding, and you will be freed from this torment." Through quivering lips, a full confession spewed forth. When it was over, the mullah patted the traitor on the shoulder in a symbolic token of mercy before stepping away and nodding ever so slightly to the cloaked executioner. When the cage door sprang open, pandemonium broke loose. Men pushed and shoved, jockeying for an unhindered view of the carnage. The cellar filled with roars of exhilaration that nearly drowned out the Dinka's screams. Jafar bounded up the stairs, seeking to flee the image and sounds of the man's face being eaten alive. He could take no more. Outside the mullah's home, alone and away from the butchery below, the horrid shrieks continued to echo within the child's mind. Visions of mutilation flashed before his eyes. His knees buckled, and he vomited onto the bark of a nearby tree. When his stomach emptied, the boy lifted himself up and began to stumble down the narrow lane of the village toward the safety of his home. With every step, imagined howls and horrific visions continued to torment him. Even at such a young age, Jafar sensed he would never be the same. Innocence was lost. Seeds of darkness had been planted within his fertile mind, where they were destined to ripen and grow, and ultimately define his character and orchestrate his fate.